Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Obama administration weighing options on whether to approve a lethal drone strike against an American citizen accused of being an al-Qaeda operative. Mary Ellen O'Connell, a professor of law and research professor of international dispute resolution at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss whether or not the new counterterrorism guidelines for the president's kill list will restrain Obama, who has been criticized by the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee for not removing terrorists from the battlefield because of self-imposed red tape. Then we'll look into some of the president's appointments following the embarrassing lack of basic knowledge about the countries that the political appointees to be U.S. ambassadors to Norway and Hungary displayed in their confirmation hearings. Henri Barkey, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss his article in The Washington Post, "Obama's Ambassador Nominees Are a Disservice to Diplomacy," and the state visit by French President François Hollande, who visited Thomas Jefferson's Monticello with Obama, unaccompanied by his estranged partner, who was still piqued by the apparent affair Hollande had with an actress. Then finally, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich joins us to discuss how to address growing income and wealth inequality in America, which is the subject of a new documentary feature about him, Inequality for All. We will discuss the need for a popular revolt against the domination of our politics and economy by a handful of plutocrats and giant corporations who have purchased the best government that money can buy, a government that, needless to say, does not work for the middle class or working Americans who must mobilize to take back their government and their economy. And joining us now is Mary Ellen O'Connell, who's a professor of law and research professor of international disputes resolution at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Previously, she was the vice president of the American Society of International Law, and her books include What is War? An Investigation in the Wake of 9/11 and The Power and Purpose of International Law, Insights from the Theory and Practice of Enforcement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Ellen O'Connell.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And the U.S. Government, at least the White House and the Justice Department, are considering using a drone strike to kill a U.S. citizen abroad. This strikes me as a rather peculiar form of American exceptionalism. Does this mean that we don't have to have a debate to kill anybody else, but the privilege of being an American citizen is that we actually have a discussion about whether or not to kill you?
It's a very strange situation. You're absolutely correct. And people around the world should take note that, in my view, all of this killing with drone strikes using Hellfire missiles outside of armed conflict zones is unlawful. We're talking about in the region of 4,100 people. But if you're an American citizen, there's even more scrutiny in your case. So all of this killing is unlawful. But somehow, if you're an American citizen, you get at least a modicum of due process that people of other nationalities do not get.
And in the case, I mean, the fact that it's being discussed openly also has a surreal feel to it, doesn't it, in terms of military utility? I mean, wouldn't this person know that this discussion is going on?
This is part of the reason why this killing is unlawful. It plainly isn't part of a battlefield situation, an emergency, stressful situation in which you have to use major firepower because you're facing an enemy also wielding major firepower. This is about clandestine tracking, espionage, information gathering, carefully planning and strategically moving into operation with our clandestine agents, the CIA. This has everything to do with a clandestine type of killing and not a battlefield killing. It's the same kind of killing in its setting that the CIA was carrying out during Vietnam in Central America, and is why our church committee said that the CIA needed to stop all this unlawful, lethal or fatal operations. It's as much as a surprise as it is in every respect. One of them is that this kind of paramilitary operation by the CIA has come back online in such force under President Obama.
Well, aren't these parts, I mean, first of all, aren't the Justice Department acting under these new counterterrorism guidelines that were adopted by President Obama last year? And my understanding is that the guidelines have taken the CIA out of the assassination business and put the Department of Defense into that business. Is that what the change amounts to?
Apparently, that's what President Obama was aiming to do, and that was at least one step in the right direction. It would not make it any more lawful for the military to carry out these kinds of killings outside of combat zones, but at least the military are trained and they are recognized under international law when they are on a battlefield as having the legal right to participate in hostilities, something that is plainly not allowed to the CIA. As I understand it from reading the very good reporting that we've all seen in the last few days, the Obama administration is having difficulties moving the CIA out of its paramilitary role because of the members of Congress who are insisting, Democrat and Republican, that the CIA continue in this unlawful role. So it is another twist in this very unfortunate story of U.S. unlawful killing that our Congress, who should be overseeing executive branch and ensuring that we're in compliance with our obligations at home and abroad, are the ones who are pressuring the administration to continue using the CIA for this kind of lethal operation.
Well, specifically, the chairman of the House Select Intelligence Committee, Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan, he's on the weekend, he alluded to this, what he considers to be red tape. He's actually frustrated that, quoting him, individuals who would have been previously removed from the battlefield by U.S. counterterrorism operations for attacking or plotting to attack the U.S. attack against U.S. interests remain free because of self-imposed red tape. So that's the kind of pressure you're talking about, right? He's gung-ho. He wants to pull the trigger, and he wants, I guess, if he's overseeing the intelligence services, he probably wants them to stay in the assassination business. Is that?
That's what I understand as well. So now, how do you influence the person who is supposed to be exercising the maximum oversight of your executive branch and is actually urging them into a lawless policy? In the end, in this country, it's up to the electorate, those who put Mr. Rogers in his job, to contact him and say, we want the United States to stand tall in the world, to be in compliance with the rule of law. And by the way, every counterterrorism expert that you can find, independent, not being paid by the government, will tell you that these kinds of military operations, especially clandestine, lawless attacks that end up killing many innocent bystanders as well as the intended targets, this does not help a country resolve a problem with terrorism. It has quite the opposite effect. So if Americans want to regain their reputation and standing in the world, if they want to ensure that they as citizens enjoy the fundamental due process rights that they are guaranteed in their Constitution, and if they want to ensure that other human beings around the world also enjoy their rights as human beings, their rights under the concept of human dignity, they should call their elected officials, and especially Mr. Rogers, and urge him to get this country back into compliance and away from this path of lawlessness we've been on since 9/11.
So what do we know about the target, Mary Ellen O'Connell? Apparently it's not the American spokesperson for al-Qaeda, Adam Gadan. He's considered more of an official, if you will, with al-Qaeda as opposed to a field operative. So do we know who this person is and where this person is located?
I don't think we can necessarily assume that it's not the individual you just named, for the reason that, remember, Anwar al-Awlaki, the first United States citizen who was intentionally targeted, he is one of four now who have actually been killed by the United States. He was a publicity person. He was managing the website. He had very little to do with violent conduct, and as far as I am able to gather, nothing to do with actual battlefield operations, with participation in hostilities of any kind. So I'm not certain it's enough to get yourself off the president's kill list if you are involved in managerial or publicity or these kinds of other, let's not forget, criminal conduct, but even farther away from anything the administration can pretend is part of hostilities. So I'm not certain that we can take him off the list. And on the other hand, what we do know is that in the last several years, as a part of the negative consequence of drone attacks and the increasing disfavor that the United States enjoys throughout the Middle East, more and more people, including people who are dual citizens or who have attained American citizenship and then left, are joining such organizations, terrorist organizations. And the other thing we know from the AP story is that this individual is apparently not in the countries where the U.S. has been regularly attacking with drones for 11 years, Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. So that's a very worrying additional aspect to this case, that we're seeking to spread the places to expand where we're carrying out lawless military strikes with drones against persons who are not plainly obvious. This is they're not going after somebody who is a well-known member of the operational higher organization of al-Qaeda. So many of the things that we thought would happen after the president's speech in May at the National Defense University, that we would be doing fewer strikes, that they would really be against these high-value al-Qaeda targets, that they would minimize and end any killing of bystanders. Again and again, one strike after another, and we see that wedding convoys are attacked, persons who do not rank in the highest levels of al-Qaeda, who are not even properly members of al-Qaeda, are continuing to be targeted, and we see no end in sight. Rather, we see the executive branch not standing up to the Congress and even fulfilling the promises that they had made to the American people about moving the CIA out of its mere paramilitary role. So I think we'll very quickly find out who this individual is. This is the kind of information that will be hard to keep quiet much longer, so we'll know. But I, other than knowing this person is not one of the organizational leaders of al-Qaeda today, of core al-Qaeda, and that he is not in one of the usual targeted countries, it indicates so much to us that he could be in many other countries where governments are not willing to cooperate with the United States to bring these individuals to justice. Part of the reason for that is our history of lawless drone strikes.
Well, it's probably likely, at least to my mind, Mary Ellen O'Connell, that the target is in Iraq, which is where al-Qaeda is actively operating. They just have been flying their flags over state buildings in Fallujah. And if yes. if it's not Iraq, then you have the irony of Syria, where there's a civil war going on. Now, my understanding...
It could also be Nigeria. It could be Iran. There are several other countries.
Right.
Which is part of my point. Algeria, Mali, Niger... there are many other countries where individuals are attracted to anti-American terrorist organizations and where the governments are not willing to be supportive of us in the way that, for example, Yemen, after the 2000 Cole attack on the United States, the USS Cole, it's blown up in the harbor of Yemen, the Aden Harbor, and the FBI went immediately. A very well-known FBI agent, Ali Soufan, did an excellent job of gathering information, very quickly rounding up the henchmen. That was a model case of how you deal with terrorism and how you begin to build a criminal justice system in the countries through cooperation where it's needed. And instead, we have gone this other path, and we're still hard at it. 11 years after the first strike, with no end in sight, and yet, and in fact, a growing number of countries where these violent individuals are interested in taking refuge and are getting that refuge. So it's extremely puzzling to me that we would pursue such a counterfactual, counterproductive path. It seems to be playing well, or it did play well for a long time in the media, but it even now, I think we're getting very good and accurate reports about how effective and how useful over time this kind of policy is. So why it continues today, this particular case, should really be bringing about a great deal of pushback from the American people and from populations around the world.
And, of course, Ali Soufan, that you mentioned, to some extent blew the whistle on this torture going on in the Bush-Cheney administration.
Yes.
He had an op-ed in the New York Times, and he was leading the FBI's efforts in interrogation, as opposed to the lawless, off-the-books activities of the CIA and the Bush administration. John Yoo had this peculiar finding for, which the point that Ali Soufan was making was, of course, that their tactics, the FBI's tactics, which were not anything to do with torture or coercion, but actually empathy was used. That worked as opposed to the brutality that apparently it's been well established for decades, that if you torture people, they'll say anything for the torture to end, and therefore the information is useless. So,
yes, well, I'm married to an interrogator, so I'm very familiar with that. Yes, I was a former professional military educator, and I'm married to a United States Army interrogator. And this was obvious to us at the beginning when the first report started coming out that we were using torture. My husband immediately said, first, who in the CIA is even trained to use torture effectively, if it ever were effective? And the questions don't end, but you can ask these same questions about targeted killing with drones.
Right.
Where is the evidence that any of this works? Why did we abandon what has worked? Let's look at the case of the British, who had a very tough problem with terrorism I'm very familiar with, given my family history. And the British first tried too much force, excessive force, torturous kinds of interrogation tactics, really inhumane conditions. The European Court of Human Rights said, you're not allowed to do this as a rule of law nation. The British, to their credit, turned that program around and began to pursue old-fashioned, very solid law enforcement, winning back the trust of the community. And we have a much better situation on the island of Ireland than we can find in centuries. So why wouldn't the U.S. look at it in a successful case like that instead of ginning up per Mr. Yu's ideas about how the world works, a very effective program against al-Qaeda, using all of our very best interrogators like Mr. Soufan or my husband, if you are working on persons detained on an actual combat zone? Or why wouldn't you use people who know what the Geneva Conventions say about who may be targeted and who not, or police rules about when you may shoot a defendant, a suspect who is resisting arrest? Ironically, we seem to use these rules far more closely in the apprehension of Osama bin Laden than we have with respect to these other dozens of people on the president's kill list. Some of those people we didn't even kill because we wanted them dead. We killed them because some friendly person in the Pakistani intelligence services said it would be a quid pro quo for our access for drones to kill other people, that we would kill such individuals as Baitullah Masood. I mean, this is not the country that I thought it was, that we are carrying out that kind of activity, although I'm always quick to add, we can be again. We did stop using torture, and I'm confident we will end this targeted killing program. It's just going to take more pressure from our friends and allies and from the American people on their elected representatives.
Well, Mary Ellen O'Connell, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the excellent questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Mary Ellen O'Connell, who's a professor of law and research professor of international dispute resolution at the Kruk Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Previously, she was vice president of the American Society of International Law, and her books include What is War? An Investigation in the Wake of 9/11 and The Power and Purpose of International Law, Insights from the Theory and Practice of Enforcement. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the embarrassing lack of knowledge on display by Obama's nominees to be ambassadors to Norway and Hungary. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has co-authored and authored a number of books, including Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East and Iraq, Its Neighbors and the United States. And he has an article at the Washington Post, Obama's Ambassador Nominees Are a Disservice to Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it is pretty shocking to watch the sort of these nominees that President Obama has put up trying to defend their appointments, in effect, before the United States Senate. You mentioned, of course, the Long Island campaign bundler, George Tsunis, who has been nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to Norway, not having, first of all, admitting he'd never set foot in the country, didn't know that Norway was a monarchy. And then, of course, the other person who's even more embarrassing, I think, is a soap opera producer from out here in Hollywood, who is going to be ambassador to a very important country, Hungary, which is in a political crisis and is moving dangerously to the right. So we've criticized other presidents in the past. I take it this indicates that President Obama is no different from his predecessors in political appointees.
Well, unfortunately, that it looks like that. I mean, every single president has appointed political appointees to different embassies, and increasingly you're seeing this, especially in Europe, because Europeans are considered to be essentially easygoing, and you don't really need heavy lifting when you go to Europe, whether it's Sweden or Norway or Denmark, for that matter. But what is shocking is that I think a lot of us, including myself, expected more from Obama. We did expect, you know, better qualified people. It's okay to send political ambassadors. There's nothing wrong with it, provided the political ambassador is qualified and has something to say. Maybe is an expert on the country. We have, incidentally, I only mentioned Norway and Hungary, but there's this whole slew of other ambassadors. Apparently, the one appointed for Argentina as well has never set foot in Argentina and basically said, "Well, I'll go to Argentina after I'm approved as ambassador." Now, you know, you would think that people like Tsunis, who clearly is very wealthy and has been a bundler, would, if he was nominated to go to Norway, would just go as a tourist, just to find out, just to look around, just to be able to say at the committee, "Look, yes, I've been to Norway. I mean, I'm not an expert on Norway, but, you know, I've been to Norway and I've talked to people in Norway." I mean, he could have said all these things, but like the approach that these appointees are also taking is insulting to the very people we are sending them to. So what is a Norwegian or Argentinian or Hungarians is to think about people who are completely ignorant of the country they're going to serve in. And I think it's a terrible sign for the United States. It's also a bad sign for President Obama, who made a great deal of incompetence and running the government professionally, etc. And when you watch the people being quizzed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you are embarrassed. And do we want people like that to represent the United States? I mean, these people are perfectly good at their jobs, whatever it is they do, whether it is producing a soap opera or being a hotel magnate, as in the case of Mr. Tsunis. They're very good at their jobs. But as I said in my article, if you have a plumbing problem, you don't call an ambassador to fix your plumbing problem. You call a plumber. You call somebody who knows something about it. Why is it that we assume that in the case of diplomacy, anybody can do diplomacy? And in fact, diplomacy is very difficult. I'm not saying necessarily, again, that we need to send always professionals, but we need to send people who have some notion of what diplomacy is about, has a notion of what the history of the country, the complex relationships that are involved. I take the case of Argentina. I mean, Argentina is going through a tremendous economic crisis now. And as a president who's beleaguered, the country is turning against her. And this is a country that is, very large, is a major exporter, and in terms of South American stability, is an important country. And you're sending somebody who is clearly unable to deal with this. And just think of something else. Any of these political appointees who have no experience will go to a meeting with a, let's say, prime minister or a foreign minister, and then they're going to have to come out and remember what was said to them and write a cable back. And they will need to have somebody with them, which also means that very often when you have a note taker, you cannot, foreign dignitaries or foreign ministers will not necessarily give you, will not be very honest, because if there's a note taker, there's somebody else in the meeting, they will be a little bit worried. So they can't pass on the messages that you want them to pass on, because Mr. Tsunis is not going to be able to come out of a meeting and then write a cable back to Washington. I mean, these cables are complicated. They are, it's not a little note that you drop on an email. So what I'm trying to say is that we're talking about very complicated processes for which these people are unprepared.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence. And he co-authored and authored a number of books, including Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and Iraq, Its Neighbors, and the United States. He has an article at the Washington Post, Obama's Ambassador Nominees Are a Disservice to Diplomacy. Well, when you talk about Tsunis and Colleen Bradley Bell, the television soap opera producer here in Los Angeles, even if they haven't set foot in these countries, you'd at least think they would have Googled Hungary or Googled Norway or gone to Wikipedia. That's the part of it I don't understand.
Right. Look, it's not that. I mean, the truth is, before you go in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the State Department prepares you. I mean, these people haven't gone unprepared, and this is what's so shocking about it, because the State Department is a serious institution. They will have their nominees well-briefed. I've participated, for instance, in a number of seminars for different ambassadors who have gone to different countries, where the State Department brings experts to talk to those ambassadors in different topics on the country they're going to. So there is a great deal of preparation. A lot of men and women go into preparing these nominees before they go in front of the committee. So in a way, it's doubly shocking. I mean, this is something that it should have occurred to me to put it in the article, that the ignorance in the committee is particularly vexing, precisely because I know how much work went into preparing them before they went in front of the committee. So despite all that preparation, they were incapable of accurately describing the country they were going to. That Sunnis didn't know whether it was a monarchy or a republic. He didn't understand which parties were in the government, which were in part of the coalition, which were in opposition. But these are elementary stuff. So these poor people at the State Department who spent probably hours preparing them and creating mortar boards and all that kind of stuff must be so upset that all their efforts was for naught, because clearly, the night before they went in front of the committee, they didn't even bother to look at their notes. And there's an arrogance here. Oh, I'm going to be accepted anyway because this is a political appointee, and you know, usually the committee does not reject such people, right? And they're also displaying a certain amount of arrogance, which makes, I think, matters a lot worse. And that's I mean, there's a great deal of reaction to this. And it's sad because as I look at some of the reaction, it is a little bit partisan in the sense that the GOP and conservatives have essentially made a cause célèbre out of this. The truth is the Bush administration did exactly the same thing. I mean, it's not – we do this far too often. And maybe the time has come to stop this. And maybe the Senate should reject one of these one of these people and force the administration to rethink its strategy. I mean, there are plenty of people who could be sent to Norway that are much better than Mr. Sunnis, or to Hungary than Ms. Bell. And
well, Hungary in particular, I would say, is because it is a NATO country, and it is a country under severe threat from a very right-wing government that's taking over the judiciary, going after the gypsies, showing very fascistic tendencies.
I agree, but Ian, I mean, I don't want to make a distinction that Hungary is more. Shall we say, even though I do imply that in my article, that one has to be more careful with Hungary and not with Norway. Norway is also a NATO country. Norway has always been a gateway in terms of watching the North Sea and Russian submarines, etc. Norway is a major contributor to all kinds of international relief efforts. I mean, the Oslo process has been used not just in the Middle East, but also within Turkey. I mean, this is a serious country. I mean, it's small, it's rich, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should send somebody who's ignorant. In fact, it calls for somebody who can marshal the resources that Norway is ready to deploy in terms of peacekeeping and all kind of stuff like that, to make this world a better place.
Well,
what is he going to do? What ideas would he have about the relationship between Norway and the United States? None. Zero.
Well, what you're implying in your article, though, Henri Bakke, that the Norwegian lawmakers who just nominated Edward Snowden for the Nobel Peace Prize may well have been acting out of pique at the...
It's possible. I mean, look, yeah. This was a supposition. This was a hook for the article to start the article. Mm-hmm. It may or may not be. I don't know these lawmakers, but I do know, because I've heard it from many, many different sources, that the Norwegians are really very upset at this nominee, and they have been upset for a while. It's not new. It's not because of Mr. Sunnis's performance the other day in front of the committee. I mean, they have known about him, and they obviously interacted with him before. And I've heard this that the Norwegian embassy and people in Norway, and I've seen articles. I mean, basically saying, why are you doing this to us?
Well, let's turn a little, if we can, in the last couple of minutes, Henri Bakke, and talk about President Hollande of France's state visit to the White House. This is the first time, I think, since There was Chirac visited Bill Clinton in 1996.
Right.
And clearly it comes at a time for Hollande where his personal problems have dominated the agenda in France. His jilted girlfriend, I don't believe he's married, is he?
No, he's not.
She's apparently...
He clearly doesn't believe in that institution.
No, well, he was clandestinely visiting his actress girlfriend and on a motor scooter with a helmet so he couldn't be seen. So she's apparently off in the Maldives or somewhere in the middle of the Indian Ocean. So she's not going to be coming on the trip. So short of the tabloid stuff that's been dominating the headlines as far as Hollande is concerned, where's the substance in this trip?
Well, I would say there are two main issues here. One is foreign policy, and by foreign policy, you do see in Hollande a president who, surprisingly, for his background, etc., has taken a very, very hard line on a number of issues, intervention in Africa, Iran, and on Syria. And remember that Hollande was ready to send the bombers with Obama when Obama was considering bombing Syria for the chemical weapons use. And it's only at the last minute that President Obama changed his mind, but the French were the only country who were going to support the U.S. action. In a way, it's interesting, considering how Chirac and the French were opposed to the United States intervention in Iraq. It's interesting that this French president, despite the fact that he comes from the Socialist Party, has been far more supportive of the United States' hard line against Iran and Syria, even more so than the United States itself in some respects, and also has been willing to use power and military force in Africa in order to fight insurgencies and support and support allies. This said, Hollande is in terrible, terrible trouble at home. He is very, very unpopular. His economic policies have essentially resulted in nothing. He came essentially promising to reduce unemployment. Not only this hasn't happened, but economically, one can argue that that France is doing much more poorly. I mean, France is in a serious economic crisis, and it's important because with Germany, it's one of the two most important engines of the European Union. And if France starts to falter, as it is now, it will bring a great deal of instability to the European Union. So those two issues are the ones that are going to dominate. Now, Obama is essentially honoring Hollande for what Hollande has done in terms of foreign policy, but there's not much he can do to help Hollande economically. And I would also argue that, you know, if Hollande is trying to improve his domestic image by traveling here, I'm not sure it's gonna help him that much. But when you look at his popularity ratings, his poll ratings, I mean, they're really dismal, very, very dismal. And yes, the election is still a distance away in France, but he would be clobbered today if there were elections.
And of course, the two went to Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, and I guess that is a revival of the ties between these two countries that go back to the American Revolution. And there was an agreement on addressing climate change, but nothing in terms of what you're talking about, which is stimulating France's economy, which not to suggest that we don't need our economy stimulated too. So,
well, I mean, fair enough. I mean, there's the truth is, you know, some countries are going through a very severe crisis. And the French crisis was long in the making, and therefore it is not something that can be reversed that quickly. And it took Hollande essentially a year and a half, maybe 2 years, to essentially get his act together in terms of trying to figure out what it is he was going to do. And so he has an uphill battle to fight. And this United States there's not, as I said, there's not that much U.S. can do, in part because U.S. is still recovering from the 2008 crisis and still has severe budget and balance of payments deficits. But, you know, the optics will look good. I don't think it's going to amount to much.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and co-authored and authored a number of studies and books, including Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and Iraq, Its Neighbors, and the United States. He has an article at the Washington Post, Obama's Ambassador Nominees Are a Disservice to Diplomacy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about his new film, Inequality for All. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Reich, the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Hello, Ian. Good to talk to you.
And we now learn, of course, that in terms of inequality for all, it's a global issue. Just before the Davos, recent Davos conference in the Swiss Alps, Oxfam came out with a report that only 85 individuals on this planet have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the globe's population of 3.5 billion people. So your film is right on the money, right?
Sadly, it is. Inequality keeps growing. Not only in the United States, but in every advanced, rich nation. Now, global inequality has been with us for some time, obviously. But when you have every advanced nation and then some developing nations, certainly inequality is rampant in Russia and in China. The combination is, you get the combination that Oxfam showed, that you've got 85 people who have as much income, as much wealth, as half of the entire world's population.
So recently there was a front page story in the New York Times indicating that, in effect, we are in a plutonomy. Our economy has become a plutonomy. And I remember a few years ago there was a leak from a memo from a Citigroup of an analyst inside Citigroup suggesting that maybe we could get by with our consumer economy depending entirely on the rich. This recent report in the New York Times indicates that sales of luxury goods and at high-end restaurants are up, and at low-end restaurants like McDonald's are up. But in the middle, the Sears, the JCPenney's, and the Olive Garden restaurants are really hurting. So I recall in your film, Nick Hanauer, the patriotic billionaire, basically saying, look, I'm a rich guy, but I can't go to 300 restaurants. In fact, I don't like dining out.
Ironically, Ian, that's one of the big problems from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, because when so much of our income and wealth is going to a smaller and smaller number of people at the top who can't possibly spend it, I mean, even if they tried, 24/7, they couldn't possibly spend everything that's coming into them. The vast middle class, meanwhile, doesn't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going. Since the recovery began, the recovery from the Great Recession, and I say so-called recovery, I mean, most people don't feel like they are actually in a recovery, but since it began in September of 2009, 95%, 95% of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%, which means that, most people are not seeing any recovery. And that means they can't turn around and buy very much. And if they can't turn around and buy very much, then the economy is kind of stuck. It's a vicious cycle. It's just the reverse of the virtuous cycle we had in the 1950s, 1960s, and early 1970s, in which a growing middle class had the ability to turn around and buy things that generated more jobs and better wages.
Well, your film, Inequality for All, points out, I think, in many ways that we go through these cycles in American history. We had the original Gilded Age back at the turn of the 20th century, and that was followed by the accidental presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, a progressive era, then the Depression, and then the era that you pointed out from 1947 to 1977, we effectively had a social democracy. But then since Reagan, it's gone in the opposite direction. So what's your sense of where we are in terms of these ebbs and flows?
Well, we're coming up to what is probably a tipping point. That is, when median household incomes are dropping, adjusted for inflation, but a small group at the top is getting wealthier than they've ever been before, and they are paying a lower and lower percentage of their income in taxes, then the ranks of the poor are growing. Well, that's a recipe for social and economic and political disaster. I mean, we can't continue to go in this direction, obviously. So the choice is either reform, which is the usual choice we've taken. As you said, in the progressive era, between 1901 and 1914, we chose reform. In the New Deal, during the Great Depression, we chose reform. In the 1960s, with regard to civil rights and voting rights, we chose reform. Now, this time, if we don't choose reform, we're going to be in a terrible, vicious cycle that gets just worse. I mean, what's the alternative to reform? The alternative to reform is revolution, and revolution is very risky. Revolutions can turn out very, very badly. The American Revolution turned out pretty well, but not all revolutions do. I would opt for reform, and I think that that's the likely U.S. response, the likely American response. But the question is, when? Is it going to happen in the next couple of years? Are Americans going to become so concerned and upset with this the huge gap, not only economically, but a gap between our ideals of equal opportunity and not having an aristocracy that passes on its wealth to a kind of a dynasty, dynasties of wealth, a country that's becoming more and more unequal? Are we going to become upset to the point where people begin organizing and mobilizing and taking action, political action? Or are we going to just simply to wait until things get so out of kilter that the economy cannot function, our democracy is so overrun with big money that it cannot even begin to respond, we have no choice but sort of an uprising?
So do you sense, though, in this election year, this midterm election year, that this issue of inequality is in the zeitgeist? I know that the president has made some speeches along those lines, and my sense is that unless this year the White House pulls out all the stops and runs as though they're running in a presidential election, because it's really about turnout. If you look at 2008, 145 million voted. 2 years later, the Democrats got trounced in the midterms, where only 75 million voted. So if the Republicans have learned something from the last election, they're going to spend more money. They're probably going to have clever strategies. So unless the Democrats have turnout, I think that we're going to have a very lame duck president. And if the Republicans take the Senate, then the plutocracy has a lock, not that they don't already.
Yeah, well, that easily could be the case. Democrats need to be talking about this. If there was ever a case for a Democratic Party, it is now. If there was ever a case for a Democratic agenda in terms of a shared prosperity, it is now. Increasing the minimum wage, substantially, making it a living wage, raising taxes on the very wealthy, and reducing Social Security and payroll taxes on low-wage workers, getting rid of the tipped minimum wage, which is a scandal. I mean, you know, tipped workers are only earning $2.13 an hour. Reviving the Glass-Steagall Act so that Wall Street doesn't have another bout of melting down because it's taking too many risks with your money and my money. Putting a cap on the size of the big banks. We could go on and on. Real investments in education and job training, not the kind of around the investments we're making are paltry compared to what we need. And the same thing goes for infrastructure. We've got so many long-term unemployed. We ought to be putting people to work, rebuilding the country, teachers' aides, and working on roads and bridges and parks. You know, a new WPA, a Civilian Conservation Corps, like we had in the 1930s. This country has shown itself in the past to have the resilience to do what is necessary. And the question now for Democrats and for the rest of us, even if you are not political, is to become politically engaged and push the politicians in this direction.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Reich, the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. So as long as, of course, as we export our jobs and import cheap labor, structurally it seems that we're doomed. And talking again about the 85 individuals that have wealth equivalent to half of the world's population. It does seem that Adam Smith's idea of capital transcending sovereignty is happening, that we have a kind of global group of plutocrats who really don't have any adherence to national policy. Could we have a movement towards a patriotic economy? I mean, in other words, can we...
Ian, we've got to be very careful. If we go back into isolationism and chauvinism and jingoism, the kinds of things that have caused huge problems in the past, then we're not really improving standard of living for anybody, and we're condemning many people in developing nations to lives of deep hardship and poverty. One of the worst things we do, for example, is to give our wealthy agribusinesses gigantic subsidies, and we have tariffs on agricultural imports, which hurt developing nations desperately because they are dependent on their agricultural exports, don't help average workers in this country who have to pay more for the food that they buy, but end up really just enriching a handful of not really farmers. They're called farmers, but they're really giant agribusinesses. Well, that's the kind of thing that we've got to crack down on. Get rid of all of the corporate welfare. You know, we are subsidizing not only agribusiness, but the oil companies, major national gas companies. We're subsidizing military contractors. We've been doing this for years. It's getting worse. We're subsidizing the drug companies, pharmaceutical manufacturers. We are doing all of their basic research and yet giving them extraordinary patent protections. If you talk about our government, I mean, the issue is not the size of the government. The issue is who government is for. And right now, too often, the government is for the very, very wealthy individuals who are making the big campaign contributions and also the big corporations that are also making big campaign contributions. We need stronger unions in this country. Now, only fewer than 7% of private sector workers are unionized. There's no bargaining power in the private sector on behalf of working people.
Well, it would seem that since the wealthy control our government, they're getting the kind of government that they want, and it's working well for them, and that they're also at the same time telling us that government doesn't work, and that's been going on since Ronald Reagan. Where do you think the narrative, apart from your film, Inequality for All, is coming from or can come from to make people recognize that they can take back their government and they can have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people?
Well, that's why we did the film. Really, Ian, basically to connect the dots, to show people what's going on, not to create or demonize anybody, not to create villains, but to make sure people understand how the system is now working and failing to work and why it's failing to work. Getting big money out of government and out of politics is probably more important than almost anything else, because we can't do anything else until we get big money out of our politics. In the other hat I wear when I'm not teaching here at UCal Berkeley is I'm chair of a citizens group called Common Cause, which has been fighting for years, and it keeps on growing, and the fight keeps on growing as well, against big money in politics. We must do that. The Supreme Court's really insane decision in Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission, that 2010 decision, has got to be reversed. We've got to demand that it be reversed. We've got to have a constitutional amendment to reverse it, if nothing else will reverse it. And we've got to have campaign, public financing of all general election campaigns.
Well, in terms of, just to clarify, I wasn't suggesting earlier, Robert Reich, about bringing back any kind of Smoot-Hawley protectionism, but rather sort of engendering some kind of sense of patriotism in terms of our economy for people, for example. A lot of people find Apple products incredibly good, and they are, and they deserve to be successful. On the other hand, we learn that they're parking an awful lot of their profits abroad. So isn't there a question there that could be addressed?
Oh, yes, there's a huge question. I mean, big corporations, have trillions of dollars outside the United States. They're not bringing back to create jobs here. They're just parking it abroad to save money, and they're, some big companies are setting up a kind of hedge funds with all the money that they have abroad. They're not even investing it. They're not. They're doing nothing with it. This isn't building a competitive economy. This is just adding to the casino. So we do need to create both tax penalties for companies that hide their money abroad, and also tax incentives to bring the money back.
But also on a domestic front, aren't these big corporations also buying back stock and not investing in R&D and driving up the price of stock?
Yes, exactly. I mean, Apple is a sad example. I mean, you'd think of all companies that should be investing in technology and has in the past invested substantially in new technology. I mean, Apple is using a big portion of its savings to buy back its shares of stock. It's also borrowing in global lending arenas to buy back its shares of stock. Now, when companies buy back their stock, which is what companies are doing like mad now, all they're doing is they're artificially raising the price of their stock because when they buy it back, there's less stock remaining, and that creates higher demand. But that's not doing anything for the long term. That's the most unimaginative and silly way of spending your shareholders' money that anybody can imagine. Any company that is buying back its own stock, its current shareholders and institutional investors and pension funds ought to be asking, why are you doing that? Don't you have any ideas for the long term at all?
And I thank you so much for joining us, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you, Ian. I should also add that it is already on DVD and iTunes and on demand, and in a couple of weeks it will be on Netflix.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Reich, who's the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is a Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.